Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Eric Mokaya. Eric describes himself as a Kenyan living in Sweden who has a passion for financial markets. He invests in U.S. and Nordic equities and, on a small scale, in small businesses in Kenya. His day job is as an analyst at Klarna. When he's not working there, he is helping join Colossus, running the transcript, contributing to Seeking Alpha, getting involved on Twitter, and it seems like he never stops working. His story and background are fantastic, and I was happy to chat with him. I hope you enjoy listening to the two of us chat about investing. This episode is sponsored by Bastier Partners, a boutique investment bank. Bastier's founder and managing member is Nader Afshar, a fan of the pod. Our podcast is forthcoming. In the meantime, know that Nader is described as a connector, high integrity, a low-key version of Byron Trott, and a rare investment banker that focuses on the alignment of interests and everyone's incentives. I appreciate Nader allowing me to do due diligence on him and his firm, and I appreciate Bastier's support. As always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. Happy to be joined by Eric Mokaya, who could go by Mokaya, Eric, anything that's easiest, apparently. So how's it going, man?
It's good so far. A busy day at work. I mean, during the day, I work at Klarna. So I analyze new consumer targets and how we are progressing in terms of acquiring new consumers at Klarna. So that's a day job. So done now, and now focusing on the evening job, which is just reading transcripts of earnings calls around the world. So been a good day so far. How are you?
I am good. I didn't wake up feeling very well today, and then we've gotten in a bit of a catch-up mode since that. So I apologize that we're starting this out a little bit delayed, but thank you for working with me.
No worries. I appreciate being here. Thank you for calling me up. It's a rare thing to be on podcast mostly.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. You know, people have said that you're an interesting cat to talk to, so I said, all right, well, we might as well see how it goes. So where are you from?
So I'm from Kenya. I've lived there most of my life. So now I'm in almost mid-30s now. But I've grown up like two-thirds of my life has been spent in Kenya. So I've grown up in the western part of the country, which is a bit rainy and a bit more foresty than the rest of the country. It's next to Lake Victoria. From home, you could literally see kind of a tip of the lake from the far horizon. So it's very rainy there. So grown up there and then moved to Nairobi for high school. So I was there for high school for like 4 or 5 years. My high school was deep in the slums of Kangemi, I would say. It's a small part of Kenya called Kangemi. So that's where I grew up, like went for high school. A bit of tough surroundings, lots of people taking drugs and very early pregnancies and all. But somehow I managed to go through that and was very focused to become really one of the first, or at least one of the first people in my small family, my extended family, to actually get to university directly. And luckily, I was able to perform very well in the final exams for high school and was able to get to kind of the top university in Kenya called the University of Nairobi, where I studied business. I had a couple of options to choose, and one of my first options was dentistry, if I remember correctly. The second option was pharmacy. Third option was business. And the fourth option was lawyer. So I didn't get enough points to get to the dentist or the pharmacy, but I got enough points to be in the business department. And then, so here I am many years later, still doing business. So a couple of gaps in between here and there. But after that, I went to Norway for 1 year. And then I came back to Kenya for 1 year. And then I've been in Sweden now for 8 years since 2014. So it's my eighth year this August. So that's a short story of how my life has been so far and where I've been.
You said that when you were in the slums that there was a lot of, you mentioned pregnancies, you said drugs. Like, what was it that, what got you through that?
Having grown up in a tough situation, I had grown up with a single mom, and then I'd seen how she'd struggled to sustain us. So I think for me, that transformed the way I think about life. I'd seen her struggle so hard to take us to school, sacrifice a lot. So from a very young age, from age around 14, I actually left home and went to live with my uncle in Nairobi. And then I got a scholarship for high school in a very, very interesting way. I remember walking up to the principal's office and telling him, like, hey, if you give me an opportunity to study for the next 4 years for free, I'll not let you down. And then luckily for me, he gave me the opportunity. I told him, like, I actually gave him kind of an ultimatum, like, you either kick me out of school, because we'd spend the whole time like chasing in and out. So it was a paid high school, so I had to pay. But when I came in, I knew they were offering scholarships. So I was targeting that at some point they would switch my education to full scholarship. So when I came in, the whole time I didn't pay school fees. I didn't have money to pay for school fees. So what used to happen is that the class teacher would kick me out of class, and then I would go out of class, pretend to be outside for a few minutes, and then come back into playing this cat and mouse game for a whole time.
Why were you kicked out of class?
Mostly because I haven't paid school fees. So like, if you haven't paid school fees, you have to go home. So we played this cat and mouse game like the whole time. But at the end of the time, I remember I wrote in the report card, but I made sure I was a top student at the school. So like, no doubt the grades were top. And then when he looked at the bottom of my report card, he wrote, "Don't come back next term if you have not paid for school fees." So I go home, and guess who? The first student to be in class the next term. I'm right there, the first student. And then, I mean, the class teacher is at this time is now despairing of kicking me out all the time. So he sends me to the principal. So the principal's office, I write a small letter and then give it to one of the guys in front of me. In the letter, I tell him, if you don't give me a chance, if you want me to break the cycle of poverty in my family, give me a chance to go through high school. And then he gave me the opportunity to go through high school 4 years. And I think that since I was given this opportunity to study, and I knew that education is something that would transform my entire life. And my mom kept emphasizing it from a young age. So I just grabbed the opportunity with both hands and was really focused. And one day I was passing by, University of Nairobi bus. And I told myself, like, I want to be on that bus someday. And that's all, like, in terms of motivation. That's how I worked hard for the rest of the 4 years to manage to go to university directly. Yeah.
Were there any other kids that were in your position that didn't show up to school? Like, that takes a certain amount of gumption to just walk back in and say, I'm going to be here no matter what.
It does take a lot of gumption, to be honest. And I would say, like, sadly also, like, now looking at the results at the end of the 4 years, I was the top student in the school. And then I had an A, and then the rest of the students like had lower grades. And it wasn't mostly because of trying also. It was mostly because, first of all, a part of it is a lot of luck. I somehow got this opportunity to get access to really good books while at the school. But also I had a lot of dedication. I stayed late at the school. I came on Saturdays to study the whole Saturdays and Sunday. I was crazy about books because I knew, for me, I did not see a successful life outside education. Like my gift or talent was studying and being able to understand stuff. So if I knew that if this didn't work out, I did not have an option B. So then because of that, I was extremely driven to make it work. Extremely driven. I think that made a difference. But then, of course, some of the students in the class, some ended up not following the path. Many didn't follow the path that I followed. I've seen one or two have been at least out of the class that I was in, also managed to later go to university. And that's really encouraging. But at least in the slums, most kids fall out of the way, mostly because of lack of role models or people who can inspire them. Or secondly, also that lack of the gumption, like you really want this so badly that you're ready to do anything and you know that this is your way out of poverty. So I think those are the things that kept me together even during this kind of difficult time, 3 or 4 years I spent in the slums there.
I assume your mother was one of your role models. Is that fair?
Yes, she is the greatest role model I've had. She taught me a lot by the time I think I was I think age 8 there, I'd learned everything that she had taught me. And then she bought books for me, you know, like brought a lot of books and allowed me. And I remember her telling most of the teachers where I went to school that never to kick me out of school because of a lack of school fees, that she would do her best to make sure that she's up to date on that. So she's the greatest influence I've had in my life in terms of where my career has gone so far.
What was your uncle like?
My uncle, sadly, my uncle was one of those people who also invested a lot in me, gave me a place to stay for 3 years to study from. It was tough being there in the sense that by the time I came in, he had a young wife, and then the wife also brought some kids, and then we were living in this really small space. And I mean, it was a tough, I think those 3 years were some of the toughest, but my uncle provided a really good place. He tried his best to provide a good place. I wouldn't want to talk negatively about him. He passed away in 2011. And so the other person who greatly influenced is the person who gave me the opportunity to study in the high school. So he, sadly also, he passed away in 2008 before like I could say thanks to all the things that he had given me. But the opportunity to go to high school, that was great. Like, he gave me a 4-year scholarship for the high school education. And then my uncle providing me a base to stay in for 3 years. And then there's a really nice teacher who offered accommodation for me in the final year of school next to the school so that I didn't have to walk a long distance. So I think those are like key people who influence, at least in the high school, in my high school days. But after that, beyond that, like having not grown up with a present dad, I would say then, I mean, over time, I've been able to get really incredible people who, out of the goodness of their hearts, they've opened up their lives and opened up opportunities for me when they didn't have to. And I think those are some of the people like I'm also really, really grateful for along the way of life.
That's interesting. I'm just thinking I didn't have the, I guess, safest or best female figures in my life. You know, I think maybe as I've grown older, my stepmom and I have started to see things a little bit closer to the same way. But definitely growing up, we didn't. But like you, I had some people around me, specifically friends' mothers, and then a girlfriend's mom who took me in. And I think between that and my grandma, it's the only reason that I'm half normal. Otherwise, you know, things could have turned out differently.
Definitely. I think you need those kind of people who just invest in you and somehow see something good in you. And they just keep investing as much as they can and to the greatest extent they can. I know like my mom stretched herself to the upper limit to make sure that I get a good education, I stay safe, and I am well fed all throughout this year. So never lacked, at least during those days. So I think like those, I'm very grateful for those, I would say, myself.
So you studied business, and then how do you find yourself, you know, interested in investing?
That's a long journey because when I went to study business, I studied accounting. So like debit credits, so I spent 3 or 4 years just deep inside debit credits, assets, liabilities, and all. Somehow I didn't know much about finance, but I thought accounting sounded very fancy. I had no one in my family who had been an accountant, and I knew no one who was an accountant. But somehow accounting was fascinating from day one when I arrived at the university. And then to the very end, so I kept on the accounting path. I did touch a couple of times on like investing. Like I remember in 2008 in Kenya, one of the biggest IPOs back then is one of the biggest companies now in Kenya called Safaricom. So it's the biggest telecom company in Kenya, and it owns one of the largest fintech platforms in Africa called M-Pesa. So when they listed back in 2008, there was a lot of buzz in the like in the entire country about it was the biggest IPO then. Until I think to date, it's still the biggest IPO. So everyone was super interested in getting a piece of this big company. So and then I was like, okay, let me get a piece of it. So I went in, bought it at, let's say, like 5 Kenya shillings. Just to give you perspective, that's like a shilling is like, say, $1 is 100 Kenya shillings. So 5 shillings is very, very small. But then like then it was like I took all this student loan I had and put it in Safaricom. Or at least a few savings I had. And lo and behold, the share price sank to half in the space of like a year.
Oh, no.
And so that was my first taste of investing. And then so I had to, I began with a loss, but then I stayed away from investing for a long time until again I came to Sweden. I think when I came to Sweden, I had worked as an accountant for 1 year and I'd gotten bored with the debits and credits. So once you, once the system is in place and no hard feelings towards accountants, but it gets super boring. Like there's nothing new to learn after you've done with your debits and credits and you've created an entire system for a small startup that I'd created. So I got tired. So I was like, when I was coming to Sweden, I was like, I want to change. And then I found this course called financial engineering. So in my mind, I thought it was finance. But when I arrived in school, I realized it was finance. It was mathematics plus a little finance. And I think that shocked me. But luckily, along the way, I found out about the CFA Research Challenge. So they have like an annual challenge where students can sign up you just sign up and then you participate. So I quickly formed a team and then we participated. And for me, that was a huge eye-opener. So then I realized how you can use accounting information to make decisions about companies, incorporating some knowledge maybe from outside accounting, that you're able like to make this, form this perspective about a company and then use that to make decisions about where to invest your wealth for the future. And then suddenly it opened my eyes to guys like Warren Buffett. I started reading their books. And then suddenly like my world was, I was super fascinated. I'd actually did the level one of CFA within the space of like 2 or 3 years. I had actually almost completed my CFA because I was really passionate about it. This was a revelation for me. So suddenly then, I started, the company that we were analyzing in the research challenge was a Swedish company called Atlas Copco. It's one of the biggest manufacturers of equipment in the world. It's a competitor to Caterpillar, a huge competitor to them. So when I found out about them and analyzed the company, I really liked the company. I invested and again, the share price went down after I invested. Unlucky for me. So my initiation has always been like negative. But then I patiently held. It went down, I think, 10 or 20%. And I still held. And the day it reached break even, I sold everything and ran away.
What's happened since then?
So the share price has 2x, 2 or 3x. It's had a spin-off. I've missed out on dividends. So I don't know. I mean, it was my young, naive self coming to investing. But I think one or two more of these tries, I even tried day trading, got burned seriously with a couple of friends. But then I realized finally I landed on value investing, this concept of now you're buying something for less than it's worth. And then, of course, holding on until the intrinsic value kind of comes to it. So when I read about it, reading The Intelligent Investor, then I thought this makes a lot of sense. It aligns a lot with my temperament. I'm not one to check stock prices every minute of every day. It's too much stress. So then I realized I can analyze a company for a little while, invest in it, hold on it for a lot longer. Even if it goes down, if it's a solid company, it will come back up. I think with that kind of a mindset then, I think that's formed my investing journey in the last 2 or 3 years or 4 years, I would say. And that has helped me now align my investing with my temperament and skills and my eagerness to learn and desire to learn about a company deeply, much more than just doing technical analysis and all. So I think that's been my brief journey towards investing personally. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about your investing journey yourself.
Yeah, I got interested in investing. So I was in law school and graduated and knew I didn't want to be an attorney. Thought that it would be a good idea to start a franchise. I was either not the right person to start that. It was not the right business. It was not the right business for me. It was the wrong time. Some combination of events. I was trying to sell floors in 2009, which was not the greatest time to try to sell flooring. Turns out it's a pretty discretionary item. And the young, naive me said, well, no one else is spending any money on marketing. and everybody else is pulling back and they're all idiots and I'm going to come in and I'm relatively well capitalized and, you know, we're going to crush it because why wouldn't we? And it turned out that what I thought was well capitalized in Chicago certainly was not well capitalized, was step one. Step two, it turns out that the people that were pulling back had years and years and years of experience, and they were in preservation mode for good reasons. I don't know. Long story short, it was like 15 or 16 of the hardest months that I've ever had. I felt like a complete failure at the end of it. And finally come to terms with the franchisor where we agreed to let each other go our separate ways. I think I did a pretty good job actually negotiating my way out of that franchise agreement, but learned a lot. And then I was trying to figure out what was next. And I ended up getting an offer from BMO Harris Bank. You know, they brought people in analyst programs. So they said, you're not going to be able to start for, I think it was like 8 months or something like that. So I said, whatever. I just want to, I want to lock in my job. So I'll do whatever I have to do. And during those 8 months, my grandmother's friend sent me The Intelligent Investor, some Bogle book, I forget what it is, and then another book on Buffett. And I don't know if he had like a sixth sense of humor or whatever, because I basically got super bored of the Bogle book and started to try to figure out the art of investing. Prior to that, my experience with the financial markets was I had studied options trading a fair amount on my own, was never any good at it. But I think like you, so I double majored in college in accounting and finance. Enjoyed accounting until I started to do like pension liability calculations and some of the advanced accounting stuff. I was like, this is such a waste of time, because pensions were clearly going away, and two, it was just not something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I don't know.
It's a bit of a snooze. Like when you get to like pension liabilities, you get to deferred tax accounting, and they're complex. You really need to be passionate about this stuff to spend a lot of time.
Yeah. I think the my frustration with the younger me, and I guess this is how you learn. It's the old experience is what you get when you don't get what you want. But, you know, like missing Apple in 2008 and 2009, when there were like, you know, it's a global recession and there's lines out the door. Like, and here I'm saying, well, it's, you know, it's too highly valued relative to the current earnings or whatever. And, you know, aren't we in a depression pretty much? Like, gosh, that was so stupid of me. And, Lululemon's another one that I kind of kicked myself for. We'll see how like Allbirds turns out, because maybe there's a world where Lululemon and Allbirds are basically the same thing, but I don't think so. And like my wife, she was just pounding the table and she was like, you need to invest in Lululemon. And I got caught up on a multiple and I didn't kind of understand that, you know, you can pay a higher multiple for smaller companies because they can grow into it. Like I didn't understand growth and how it can create value as much as I do today. Sometimes I worry that the current environment that we're in is heaped such large multiples on growth that I've learned to overestimate the value of growth. But that's kind of where I've come from, a little bit of where I'm at. And then I tried to start this podcast to, one, like have more frank conversations with investors that I respect and people that I want to talk to, and two, to kind of create like a distributed learning platform. I think that there are some of us on Twitter realized pretty quickly the value in learning in public. And this is just kind of one more form of it, I think. And it's just delivered a pretty immense benefit. So that's where I'm at. I still don't know exactly who I am as an investor. I get pitched on some cheap special situations, and there's a part of me that can't avoid that. But there's a big part of me that just kind of lets stuff sit in, you know, reasonably good companies and lets them compound. So hopefully they continue to. Otherwise, I'll have to go back to the drawing board all over again. And then I'll probably just index.
I get you also. But again, at the same time, I've also had a similar experience in terms of like not learning that companies can grow and still, like a company can actually be valued at 12x, let's say, earnings in 2015 and still the same, can be valued at the same price in 2000 and, or even lower in 2022, having grown earnings faster than the price has actually grown. So I think that my greatest lesson is actually with Apple, because I've never owned the stock at any given point, but I loved the stock back. It was in 2016 when Warren Buffett invested in it. It was at around $94 a share then. I was like, this is so highly valued. Why is he getting in? I mean, everybody knows Apple, you know, stuff like that. So that's what I thought. And then now, like looking back, that was one of the greatest investments he has ever made, like in terms of how it's grown, not just in terms of earnings, it's grown its market share, it's produced like more products, it's strategically positioned for the future. Now service revenue has grown to a significant percentage of total revenues. It could actually be trading at a lower multiple. It's done a stock split since then, huge buybacks, incredible growth, and still has an incredible path ahead for growth in terms of being a strong company. So I think that, from just watching it on the sidelines, has been one of my greatest lessons in terms of how, what you say, like in terms of companies growing into their multiples and actually even exceeding that expectation at the end of the day. So I think that's been a great lesson for me.
Yeah, I think the hard thing to figure out is, you know, am I, like in your example, you know, are we drawing a lesson from Apple, which is one of one, that, you know, doesn't translate in the future? I guess that the old me used to think that there was more protection in buying current free cash flow, right? So if I have a 10% yield out of the gate, that's safer than a 3% yield that I think will grow to 6 and may have multiple compression. I think what I appreciate more now is that the market's pretty smart. And if you have a 10% free cash flow yield out of the gate, you really got to defend why that's defensible, because I don't think that those are just offered up, right? And then the other part of that too is, I think some of those companies are going to put a very hard management decision to you probably sooner than the earlier growth one, or than the growth ones are. But I don't really know that that's true. I mean, I think the thing that scares me about growth investing generally is, you know, if you pay a large multiple on current performance, if you find out quickly that you were wrong, that's really going to hurt. But really, I don't think you should find out whether or not you're right or wrong for 3 to 5 years, because the future is, at least the market implies that the future is somewhat, the near future at least, is somewhat baked. I still have some struggles with that. That said, I've never seen my entire life good assets lose relative purchasing power. I've always been the guy that's like, Disney can't raise prices anymore. And every single year it happens, you know, or I grew up in Florida, right? Like beachfront real estate. I mean, maybe 2008, it took a hit, but it's always been worth paying for. And I don't know if that's an interest rate comment. I don't know what it is, but it just seems to me that these like truly great and scarce assets tend to accumulate value over time.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, perhaps something else I've also learned in the process of just investing in companies, and maybe a great lesson is also about paying attention to free cash flows in terms of capital allocation, how companies are to allocate their capital. What's their long-term plans and versus how they're doing currently? Are they overambitious? Paying attention a lot to what they say in earnings calls and what they don't say, what they emphasize on. Just listening into great management teams expound about how the future plans for the companies are. And bottom line, still paying attention to how free cash flows are being spent in the company. Are they reinvesting them in earning assets, or are they wasting them away? Are they paying dividends? what are their long-term plans? How do they manage to, how do they plan to generate cash flows to sustain the business, but also like to pay up investors' dividends and all this kind of stuff, if they are going to pay dividends at the end of the day. So I think that's been my greatest lesson. So pay attention to where cash is going. Cash, you never go wrong with cash. And I think one of the greatest lessons has been also the company Peloton. I owned it for a little while, but then I sold at some point. And then I learned, like, I saw how management were fiddling around with cash flow. So at some point they say we don't see a need for cash. And then the next 10 days later, they want to raise capital in the secondary market. And I think that was a great lesson in terms of good management teams plan ahead. They see where they're going and they plan, like, they actually do tell investors ahead of time that you may need cash in the next 2 or 3 months or something. So I think, yeah, great lessons in terms of investing. But investing is also a place where you keep learning every day. It's a place where you wake up every morning, and once you pick any earnings call transcript most of the time, because I spend a lot of time with that, they teach me a lot about how managements think, what they think about the economy currently, what they think about the companies, what they think about trends that they're observing in the industry, and what they see the future of some of their companies need to be like. And then following some of these companies over a couple of quarters, you can see what is repetitive jargon, or they just churn out for the sake of it, and what is actually substance. And now, like, I spend much less time with an earnings call transcript before, like, I can quickly narrow down to where the good stuff is. And so it takes me a lot less time now because I followed some of these companies for a while. And some of my favorite companies are companies like listening in to their CEOs, especially of Netflix and Disney. They have a lot of mutual respect, these two companies. You can feel it in their earnings call. They're actually some of the few companies that reference a competitor, like Netflix mentions Disney, and Disney mentioned Netflix in their earnings calls, mostly because of the respect that they have for each other's business models. But at the same time, because they also take time to discuss their business model, their strategy, why are they in certain markets and not in other markets? For instance, like, I think from listening to earnings calls, you clearly can tell why Netflix is not in the news. It's not like they're not going to provide you news at some point, like the same way the TV used to. They're not going to provide you live spots, not anytime soon. They're not going to do advertising, at least not in the near future. It's not in their plan. And then suddenly you can also see why maybe Disney themselves have greatly invested in growing subscriber growth, and now it's kind of plateaued, and now they've switched to, yes, we can provide a tier that includes advertising. So I think the greatest joy for me about investing and interacting with people on Twitter is the lessons. You learn a lot about business models and about people, and about generally also about how to manage your portfolio better. I'm not so sure how your experience has been yourself on Twitter, because you've been there for a while or so.
Man, it's been incredible. So first of all, Twitter is the reason that I found, that I reconnected with Toby Carlyle. And then he put me on Value After Hours, and the connections that I've made through that have been just great. And then, you know, I started this podcast, and Twitter is the only way that I've really marketed it. And to be able to speak with some of the people that have agreed to come on the podcast, is like stuff that I never, not in my wildest dreams did I think that I would have some of the guests that I've had. So it's just been awesome. And then what I've been able to sort of parlay that into, and I'm grateful that I've deserved the opportunity, but I'm also grateful that people have given me the chance. Like you're talking about Netflix and Disney, and I partnered with Stream to do some of their interviews to build out their content library. And, you know, I was just curious because I hear a lot of people say, well, Netflix will probably go ad supported, whatever. So I've done some research on building out, you know, an AVOD product. And they're just like insights. One of which, somebody that was in charge of building out a AVOD product for a company said, you know, one of the problems is, when you're ad supported, a lot of the glitches when you're watching a streaming product is actually the ad technology in the background. So like if you're Netflix and you're focused on delivering a constant, quick, reliable feed, adding an ad-supported tier can actually kind of potentially hurt that. So it's just like a little insight like that that makes me realize maybe this is why they don't want to mess with, you know, ad-supported, because their core offering is a reliable, quick experience that is subscription-based, right? And there's a lot of different examples of that. But, you know, I don't know. Twitter's been an incredible, it's changed my life for the better.
Me too, especially in terms of meeting people. I haven't been, surprisingly, I haven't been to the US, but I have a good network of people and friends that I've met on Twitter that we talk to at least often, and especially also interact. I would say it's through Twitter that I was able to actually meet Colossus, the guys.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
It's serendipitous, to be honest. Like I've been on Twitter for 4 or 5 years, and I actually don't know how I landed on Twitter. I guess it was mostly because of guys like Masters in Business, Barry Ritholtz. So I was listening to the podcast, and then they referenced Twitter. And then I came to Twitter and then suddenly found the Ritholtz gang. Back then, they were fresh. They were really new. So I joined in, listened to all their podcasts and content, read their newsletters. And then I think slowly I found Patrick Oshogunsi, and then I switched to his content also. Like I've listened to almost his entire library of podcasts from almost the very beginning. And then through that, I reached out to Brent Bishore, got to talk to him a couple of times. I mean, it's been evolving. It's been a great network. It's a bit of a rolling stone that keeps gathering some moss along the way. So like you keep going downhill. Or at least uphill, and then you keep meeting all these people. And then if someone knows someone, everyone is kind of 1 degree removed from you. So I talk to Brent and maybe know someone else out there. So I think that was what happened. And then I think a year and a half ago, or two years ago, what I did is I really liked the Chris Blomstrand episode of one that they had of Invest Like the Best. So the title of the podcast is called it's a quality company, like what a quality company is. The reason I love the podcast, it's like a deep dive into several companies. So I think the first one is Cummins. They do a deep dive on Dollar Tree, I think. But the deepest deep dive, of course, is on Berkshire Hathaway, which spends half the episodes just explaining how they do their accounting, how they do what's the fascinating aspects of their various business models. And then he explains how Warren Buffett has made some of the best deals of his life, like acquiring some of the biggest companies since and pivoting from time to time from being almost exclusively focused on equity and then investing in bonds and stuff like that. So I think that was incredible for me. So having listened to the entire podcast, what I did is I took the podcast and created a transcript of it. And then the transcript, I added pictures. I added links like to whatever books he had mentioned. I added I added as much content as possible. So it was a loaded kind of transcript. So I took the transcript and I was like, I sent it to... I sent a copy of it to Chris Blomstrand, and then I also sent it to Patrick. And then Patrick was very intrigued because for a while they had been thinking of turning the content that there was on Invest Like the Best into a platform where you can actually search all these transcripts of all these episodes that they created. So I was at the right time, at the right place. And then I remember interviewing to being CEO at Colossus. I didn't have the experience. So I think Damien got it. And then I was recruited in as a pioneer or at least a contributor into the program. So I think around November, December 2020, we were working on the transcripts now. I think if I remember correctly, I worked on around 40 to 50 transcripts, adding like the links, the pictures, all this stuff in it. I think that was a masterclass in business, deep dive into some of the best business minds and investors out there. And through that, I was able like to meet a ton of people at the same time. I even got to meet Chris Bromstrand, like not meet, like have a video chat with him. I've had a video chat with Michael Mobosin also. Like for me, those are like me meeting my heroes now, who I've been reading about for so long. And then ever since then, I work with Colossus like part-time. I do background research on some of the businesses that they, some of the, especially business breakdowns is my favorite. I've done close to slightly more than half of the episodes I've touched. I've done something, maybe the blocks. I've worked on the transcript, listened to the audio, done a bit of providing feedback on each of these, some of these episodes. So yeah, so it's been a great learning experience for me, especially with Colossus and working closely, at least with the team there, and sometimes also getting to meet Patrick also. So that's the small journey with Colossus on the side.
You know what's great about that story is, you know, you found an episode that you liked. You did something with it that added value to the experience. You sent it to the interested parties, and then good things happened. So a lot of the times people will be like, well, how should I get involved? Or how do I, you know, some people have asked, you know, how do I get more Twitter followers? Not in like a follower thirsty way, but more like I sometimes feel like I'm shouting into the void. And how do I get more out of this? And my answer is always like, find the people that you want to interact with, figure out how to add value to their life, and then just try to add value. And if you're not, like, pivot what you're doing. I mean, I used to hop in and out of chats like Sean Stannard Stockton at Ensemble. I love what they do. And I like their Twitter feed, right? So I would try to like add value to him. And I think for a little while, he was like, who the heck's this kid with I used to have like this beer boot, you know, as my icon. And I think he was like, who is this guy? And then eventually, you know, we started to interact, and then I met him at Manual of Ideas, and as you said, it starts to snowball on itself. And it's a really powerful community when you start to add value to it, what happens.
And my take is always like, everyone has something to offer. So if you're from a non-finance background, offer that non-finance background that you have to the pool. You know, like, not all of us know anything about, like, let's say I have a friend who's really good at genetic engineering. Like, he understands a lot of that. So, like, if you come into the platform and you're explaining to people like, okay, this is how this stuff works, people will see value in that. So like, my addition to the like FinTwit community is mostly, I spend a lot of time in earnings calls and I get good quotes. And from those good quotes, I share my insights from that. And then someone else finds them useful. And then that's how we built a small newsletter that it's not small now. We have like around 8,000 subs, free subs on that. And we've built it over a long period of time. Also, I think my network on Twitter has mostly been, it's grown slowly over time. Now it feels like it's big now, but it's mostly because like I've been patiently working slowly. The end goal, of course, was I wanted to really work with some of these heroes of mine, like Patrick, like Michael Mobosin. But you have to be patient in that regard, like build your profile slowly, get to network, and you'll be surprised, amazingly surprised, how kind and nice most people are. Like, most people, if you reach out and say, hey, can I have 20 minutes of your time just to chat about this company? Or you can tell me a little bit about how you think about this specific aspect. People are willing to give you 20 minutes. But of course, at 20 minutes, make sure you make it worth their while also. Share with them what you know and listen to them also. So I think it's a give and take, and then you build these platforms at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the key is just making sure that you're ready for the, you know, when those 20 minutes come, right? You got to not waste anybody's time. What's your newsletter called, in case people want to check it out?
It's called The Transcripts. It's on thetranscript.substack.com. So what we do there is that we aggregate key quotes from earnings calls. So it goes out every Monday by 7 a.m. New York time should be out. I partner with a friend of mine. We've met only once. Again, it's the it's this hunger and drive that actually has gotten me in touch with him. He used to write the newsletter alone like 5 or 6 years ago. And then I kept seeing the newsletter every week coming in. And what I would do is I realized he picks quotes from earnings calls. So I would pick a few quotes and send them back to him and tell him like, okay, here are my quotes, which I've seen, which you can add to your newsletter next week. And then he was intrigued, this guy, random guy from Sweden, sending him quotes. And then he was like, come in and help me read a couple of earnings calls transcripts. And then, of course, I would read. And then with time, he became busy. And then I had more time. So he gave me the newsletter to kind of go on with it. So I've kind of taken charge of the newsletter for the last like 3-4 years. We've grown incredibly. We used to be like around 3,000. Now we're around like 8,000 during this period. And then during this period is when we switched from just being free to being premium a bit so that we can pay for some of the services. We offered it free for almost 5 to 6 years. But then last year around May, Substack came, offered us a good deal, and then it came on board. Now it's on Substack and it's available for a small fee. You can support us and subscribe to our content there. And I mean, again, as you can see, like it's the power of networks. I have met Scott, the guy I work with, only once. And it's because he came to Sweden and then we met and had a cup of coffee with his family and my family also. And all this is it's online. I've met all these friends online. And now I know that I have a really good friend in California where if I go to visit him, he's an incredibly good friend to me now. And all this started from an email, just responding to an email and providing value to him and him seeing the value. And finally, now I handle a product he started and now he deems me like a co-founder of that newsletter and platform as it is now. So it's evolved. Now we have a small team that helps us also put together a few of the quotes. But generally, most of the time, it's just during weekends, Saturday and Sunday, I read like 20, 30 earnings calls transcript, extract really good quotes. I put them together in the newsletter. By Sunday evening, I have the draft ready. I go to sleep because I'm ahead of him in terms of time. So by the time I go to sleep, I leave the newsletter there. And then he works on it in the afternoon. And by the time he goes to sleep and I wake up, the newsletter draft is ready. And then we send it out by the time he wakes up in the US. So it's like...
It's good. You got yourself working 24 hours there. That's efficient.
Oh. Yeah, people ask me how I manage like to keep a track of stuff. It's mostly because of, I think, being in different time zones. So like as the markets close in the US, I'm off work here and now I can... check out how the markets are doing. And when you guys are asleep, I'm working on the newsletter and the quotes and stuff like that. And by the time you wake up in your inbox, you find the newsletter. Yeah. So I think that's...
I like it very much. Yeah. I was driving, it was last week, I was driving over this bridge that's near where I'm at. And I was like, I was thinking about doing something similar. And then I was like, the transcript already does this. So I am one of your subs. So I like what you do. Have you read the Restoration Hardware call? What do you think of that?
It's one of the most honest calls that you find on earnings calls. It's rare to find a CEO who's, I think he is a straight shooter and very, very honest. Because what I found in that earnings calls, I hope I got all the nuances. You know, there are a lot of nuances that are very unique to maybe US culture that are really hard to pick in earnings calls. So for those, I rely a lot on Scott to help me like on that. But what I got is that they are slowing down in terms of investment in the business because the visibility is very poor for them going forward. But they're not saying that they're stepping out completely in terms of investing. But they're very cautious about the future, but they're preparing at the same time for the future. If opportunities come, they will be able like to invest as much as possible. So that's what I gleaned from him. But I mean, I enjoy those kind of earnings calls where the CEO just lets loose and gives you straight from the heart. And you can feel the difference between those and scripted calls. Scripted calls, this is how it goes. But this one, you could feel he was giving you insights. He was giving you his personal perspective, comparing it to 2008 and seeing how things are difficult now compared even to then. and he even hit on the he threw some jabs at the Fed because the Fed feels that the Fed doesn't live in the normal world because they view inflation as transitory. When if you give a call to a business person, they can easily tell you like inflation is not transitory right now or something like that. What did you think of it? What did you make of it yourself?
I liked it a lot. I think everybody should listen to it. I don't think it's one of those calls that you should read because I actually think that some of the quotes that, like, I think if I was reading the words and not listening to him, I might think that he was a little bit more alarmist than he actually was. I have this weird thing with him where I'm not sure if I can trust what he's saying or not, but I also thought that that call was extremely trustworthy. So it's a tension. On the other hand, he has executed what he said he would do, and it's hard to discount that. I don't love when a CEO comes out and they say, like, we're entering the $200 billion hotel industry, right? It's like, look at the TAM expansion. That to me feels very, selling the stock story. But I also think selling the stock story is actually a fairly important role as for a public company CEO. I don't think that I used to be one of these guys that was like, oh, you should want your stock to go down. You can buy more. And now I realize how flawed that is as a way of thinking. I think it's nice in a textbook, but I don't actually believe it. I think if he can pull off the vision that he articulated in that call, it's going to be really, really impressive. And I wouldn't bet against him. I don't have any bets with him, but I wouldn't bet against him, if that makes any sense.
I get you completely. In the sense of, I also got the same from it. Like he's brutally honest. I like that from the CEOs. Like I really enjoy listening to. But he's also executed well. He has a history of execution. So like you're not, he's not telling you to blindly follow him into an alley or something like that.
Yeah.
So I would say I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on this one. I think he has greater visibility than most, and I respect the fact that he is choosing to take the company in the direction that he wants to take right now. So again, I like you. I wouldn't bet against him, but I don't have any stake in the. I don't have any skin in the game here. But I do enjoy. He's one of those CEOs that have come to enjoy the earnings calls. So. He's quite honest in his earnings calls. And that's a rare thing for most earnings calls, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going to be interested to see how they do in Europe. If they can open up, I think what he said, there's the Paris store, the London store. I think there's one in Germany. If they can open those up and Europe accepts them as a luxury brand, then I think that my doubts will officially be unjustified. Because to me, if you can make it in Europe in luxury, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah, the furniture business here is not, it's a tough one, to be honest. IKEA has a solid grounding and the mid to lower end of the market. So I think if the high end, then you have a couple of stores here, which would give you a run for your money, especially in Sweden. But yeah, so it would be interesting to see if they can pull it off. They're not coming to Scandinavia soon because Scandinavia is the home of IKEA and everyone here wants to be in IKEA. So maybe let's see how they do in Paris and London, of course.
We'll see. I say from feel, not from fact. I feel as though their furniture is large and my experience of European hotels and housing has not been as like large as America. So I'll be interested to see if they shrink the scale and whether or not like that design takes in Europe or not. But I'm sure they know this. This isn't some secret and I could be wrong. So the combination of those two things probably makes them more right than me.
Yeah. But apart from RH, which kind of companies do you listen to in earnings calls yourself? Like which ones do you spend time with?
I always like to read J.B. Hunt because I like it's early and I like to get a feel of trucking. You know, I check out all the big ones. I stay involved in Twitter. For some reason, I'm not particularly interested in Snapchat, and that might be a mistake. I find Google's to be a little bit like not it's hard to decipher much from them from their earnings call. I usually just get as much out of the financials. I always find myself listening to Ollie's. I always listen to this guy, Lorenko Goncalves from Cleveland Cliffs. So I don't know. I jump around, but I don't jump around as much as you all do. I that's why I like your service. It gives a good recap.
I there's some companies I also really do like. By the way, I avoid a company like Google, as you say. Like, no, there's really little you can gain from reading the earnings calls. They're plainest and emptiest. Amazon has a very low, like in terms of noise to substance, they have a lot more noise in their earnings calls, to be honest, than substance. But really solid companies are the ones I talked to about, like Netflix, Disney, the one you said, RH. Also spending time with companies like Redfin, Zillow, some companies like, which other ones do we like? Airlines, they've become very good sources of information in the last, especially 2 years, because of like the impact, and they really had to explain more to investors what they do and why they do and why they need money or how they're doing and projections and all. So these are some of very interesting companies also that we check.
Do you listen to Ryanair? Ryanair is like my favorite call. He's great. Is?
I should actually.
Oh, he's great. More time. Yeah, he's fantastic.
I will check that. I enjoy Southwest a lot also. And hotels also. The Marriott Hotels, their CEO passed away. Very insightful also. And who else then? Like, yeah, so we do spend a lot of time in all of these companies a lot. Oh, NVIDIA also, the tech companies. NVIDIA, my favorite is Cloudflare, the internet kind of security providers.
Yeah.
Very good ones. They have very good insights. Especially with Cloudflare, you always get a good story about a founding story from the executives about how the company is doing, or at least how the company did in the early days. And they speak a lot about their culture, their business model. If you pick any Cloudflare earnings calls, you're bound to learn a lot about their business model than you can learn by going to any platform on the internet about them. That's how
I should read them. There. I have a friend that just sold a business there, or to them.
Oh, the Cloudflare?
Yeah. Yeah, they acquired his business.
I mean, they have one of the best, I think, networks that they're building online out there. So like the more people use their platform, the more data they have to protect the internet. So their aim is just to protect the internet. So they want to make sure that all the channels through which they want to make sure that they are the channels through which all the information online flows through, and that information is safe. And for me, it's been an incredible company for me to follow and learn from. So I know the stock price has been going up and down. I invested a little a while back. So it's went up and it's, I think, down almost 50% from its all-time highs. But business model is solid still.
Yeah. Well, you know, everything got a little nutty there for a minute. And I think one of the nice things that you talked about early in your career was having some failures out of the gate, right? And then selling back at break-even. I think it's probably a better experience to have that so that you're prepared for moments like this when stocks go against you, rather than, you know, if you bought and all you ever knew was things going up, bound to be ready for a rude awakening at some point.
Yep. And I think like that's also the other thing I pay attention to a lot. I pay attention to when the stock sinks by like 30, 40%. I always ask myself, has the fundamentals of the business really changed that much as to cause that the business is actually 30% less value or 40% less valued now than it was when I bought in or something like that? So if I'm convinced that the fundamentals haven't changed much and that it's just people normally overreacting, like now for Netflix, people overreact. Like if it misses earnings, you see it down like 20, 30% because it's a growth stock and a growth story as it is. So I think every time a stock goes down, I always ask myself, is it a fundamental problem? Are people overreacting? And if they are, then I buy in and see if it then stay in for a while. So stocks going down don't worry me. I think it worries my wife more because then she looks at the investment and she's like, you're losing a lot of money. And I'm like, and then I think that's actually the most difficult part, explaining to her that, hey, this investment, even though it's down, I have the hope that it shall recover.
Yeah.
I think it was easier. It was investing was easier when I didn't have to explain to anyone why I'm holding on to a losing stock. But now I have to, at least now, because this is a little bit of family wealth, and you need to explain why is the stock down and yet you're holding it. And then the other question I also have to explain a lot to her is, if the stock is up by 20, 30% from where we bought it, why are we still holding on to it?
Yeah.
And she was actually right. In December, she told me, these stocks have gone up a lot. Can you sell them? And then I keep telling her, it's really hard for me to time the market. I can't time. I need to be, I don't know when these stocks are going to sink. But then two months later in February, almost the entire stock market sank in that sense. And most of the stocks were down, I think, at some point around 30%. And now we're at least back to around minus 10% for the year, for the year to date. But like, you sense, I think it gives you the human touch when you're accountable to someone or someone is asking questions on why you invested. And then you have to really, you have to explain to them or at least get them to understand your positioning or in terms of your investments and explain them very well to them so that they're able, like, at least either, even if you can't convince them fully to come to your side, but at least they give you the benefit of the doubt that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
I think that's been a great learning experience for me.
Yeah, I think I have similar. My wife, she doesn't bug me too much about it at all, but I feel a lot of responsibility for it, you know, and the volatility on, you know, from like 2020 to, I guess, the middle of 2020 to the middle of 2021 was beyond my wildest dreams to the upside. And then it started to roll over, which it deservedly should have. You know, I used to play golf a lot, and I'm getting back into it, but I used to play a lot. And I found that I played my best when I didn't let my emotions get involved in whether or not I had a great hole or a bad hole. I have found controlling my own emotions through the highs and the lows. And I think some of having a podcast probably exacerbated that in the beginning, because I like doing this, and it was something that people enjoyed, and that gave me pleasure. So I probably could have managed emotions better through the whole process. But, you know, at the end of the day, things are okay, and we'll see how it turns out over the long term.
I agree. Managing emotions, I think, is integral to success in investment a lot. And especially your emotions are tested most when the markets are going
up.
And they're going up, everybody's like everything is okay, life is going well. But when the stocks go down and then they stay down for a while, I think you're tested to the greatest extent possible. And I have learned to just not look at my portfolio at all when it's 20, 30% down. If I have a good conviction about the stock, I just ignore. I don't check as much as I used to before. I used to check a lot more, like every day, how is the stock doing? 2%, 3%. But now I'm like, I barely check. I think I go there like once a week or once every month now to just check if the portfolio is okay. What can I add? What can I subtract to it? So I think learning a lot in the process, I think, and becoming a better investor every day. And I think that's a goal for all of us, to be better investors every day, to learn something new every day, and to manage our portfolio almost in line with the way our personalities are. So if you're one person who gets stressed too much by looking at green and red, just close that app and just chill. Let the investments take care of themselves. And then just do your reading, relax, chill. Even if the stock market is screaming buy, 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 sell, 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 just shut it off completely and be like the guy in Omaha who only comes out to invest when he has a full conviction that this is a good company to invest in. So I think that I've learned a lot from him.
Yeah, you know, the only thing about learning from him, and I totally agree with you, but I think a younger him would have more turnover and would be playing. I think if you gave him a smaller pool of capital, he'd be investing in a lot more ideas. I think he'd be finding a lot more and they'd be a lot more obscure. I think some of what he suffers from is just the sheer amount of capital he needs to put out the door. So it limits the opportunity set, I think, quite a bit.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, in your younger age, you can afford to be more adventurous, invest in more. I would bet like he was more adventurous, even him. Compared to the people of his time, I would bet he was more adventurous also in terms of investing in stocks that have great upside, which had researched on quite well. So I think we can do that also ourselves. You don't have to be boxed into a particular type of investing. Sometimes you can, there's a company that makes sense. Yes, it's highly valued, but it makes sense to keep investing in it. The way he has consistently invested in Apple and turned out to be a massive success for him. And it's like, I mean, Apple, Google is one of those companies, people are like, yeah, everybody knows about them. Everybody's investing in them. But actually, very few people are investing in them and earning the dividend in terms of like getting value from investing in some of these well-known companies that everybody knows, but nobody seems to invest in, surprisingly. So I think that's been my greatest lesson in watching him play, especially the Apple. That's been incredible for me.
Bruce Greenwald said he had like a 3-day class that I attended, and he said that like the way he figured it, only 10% of investors are actually long-term investors, right? And then you've got 90% that are doing something else. I think, I don't know, but I think that time arbitrage, for lack of a better term, is only going to increase over time to the people that can truly take a long-term mindset. I will out myself and say one of my biggest problems I get impatient with certain positions. I manage my portfolio a little bit like I manage a fantasy football team, where I have like core positions that I don't touch. And then like at the bottom, I churn them a little bit too much. And I haven't quite figured out the right answer, because I think on one hand, I could argue we'll just put more into the core positions. But on the other hand, I don't know that I actually believe in doing that for myself. So I'm working on those thoughts. I'll probably be working on them for years.
Yeah, but that's a good one also to work on in terms of they saying you're a long-term investor, which is a cool thing to say for everyone. But then there's also looking at your portfolio and actually seeing how often does it happen, you know? So I think those are two separate things. And I think we can all work towards being long-term investors. It's a slow by slow process, because sometimes you hold a position long, and let's say your wife keeps asking you, why are you holding this position? And yes, it's losing money. You know, like, yes, you have this conviction, but you gotta let the conviction that you had in a stock play out over a period of time, and not just be like, within a month, you've turned over the portfolio again into something else. A small example, which I look at, is Twitter. I bought Twitter a while back, like a year ago. It was way higher than where it was. I think it went down by almost 40%. But then like today on the news of Elon Musk, it's up something like 25%. I mean, I would never have thought Elon Musk as a catalyst to to unlock value on Twitter. I mean, here we are, and I'm less down today than I was yesterday. And I'm grateful to Elon.
Yeah. Well, it's all going to matter about execution there.
A little bit of luck there in terms of the stock itself, but in terms of a company that actually greatly underutilizes the platform on which it is, it's Twitter, man. Like, we met on Twitter. Our networks are mostly built on Twitter. I spend half my day on Twitter checking out something, but they still don't know how to monetize how to make me spend money on Twitter. I don't think I've ever spent a single shilling on Twitter ever since I came. I signed up a platform 3 or 4 years ago. But I mean, I would love to contribute to Twitter's growth and development in terms of paying something at the end of the day. But like, they've extracted zero value, but I've extracted maximum value because my newsletter runs on Twitter. My networks, I meet them on Twitter. My investing lessons and reflections are mostly on Twitter. So like, I extract 100x more than they will ever extract from me. So So I think in terms of a greatly underutilized product, Twitter it is. And I hope someday, I hope Elon Musk shakes them up a little. And then we can get a few coins from the pockets of Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. I echo your thoughts. I still, you know, I was part of the Superfollow like testing group. And like, I still can't do private spaces. And I just don't understand. Sometimes I think that the people that work at Twitter don't even use Twitter in the way that like that would enable them to understand what that asset actually is, which is kind of fascinating to me.
I mean, with Twitter, you can build an entire community of people, but still you go off Twitter to go market them. So like for me, if I were Twitter, instead of going to buy Revue, they should have, is it Revue?
Yeah.
A newsletter platform, which no one uses. They should have just plugged into Substack. Everyone on Substack gets, you get your user list from Twitter. You market your newsletter on Twitter. Substack itself has no natural growth platform where you can share or at least tell people about it. At least they're switching to app and all. But Substack made more sense than Revue or whatever it is they took up. So I think like Twitter has a massive, I have a strong conviction that they have a massive potential. It's just that they need maybe the right people who actually use the product to actually be running the company. So I'm grateful that Elon Musk, one of the biggest users, is joining. I hope he changes something.
Well, if anything, I can tell you that I know that I know that Twitter is valuable for Tesla because they spend approximately nothing on marketing cost. And his use of Twitter is impossible to argue to me that those two things are not somewhat correlated or causal. I don't know, man. Like, why can't we respond in a direct message? Why can't we respond to a specific direct message? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And there's just a lot of these issues where it's like, do you guys use the product?
You know, there's like, why can't I search for people? You know, like it's such a simple thing. I can't search a message, and I can't search the messages. Because sometimes I've talked to someone, but I can't remember who it was, but I remember what the conversation was about. I can't find people. The advanced search function, at least that's powerful, but like still, I can't save stuff to bookmark. Like apart from bookmark, which is crazy in itself, searching for something inside there. Like it's such a, I wish someday they learn to utilize. I would pay for some of those products if they were available, if they would make life easier.
Are you eligible for Blue, for Twitter Blue? Because that has a pretty decent bookmark function.
Last time I checked, I wasn't able because I think it wasn't available outside the US.
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but it makes sense. I used Blue for a little bit. I didn't get quite the value out of it that I think I could have. But if it had more features, I'd probably keep using it.
I mean, they have the opportunity to enhance the product. If they provide more features, I would gladly pay for Blue at that point in time. So I feel sad for Twitter for now, but I hope someday they unlock their potential.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I had owned it for a hot minute. And then my experience with Superfollows is what got me out of it. But, you know, I don't know, $40 billion market cap could make sense. I'm not sure that I'm there now. I would like to see more execution. I'd like to at least believe that they know what to do with the product to spend that kind of money on it. But I don't disagree that there's a lot of potential there. I saw it once. I could probably see it again. I just need to open my eyes again, potentially.
Let's hope that they see the value and actually utilize it well. I really hope so in the near future.
What else do you look at? Do you look at any small caps or anything international?
Internationally, right now I'm super interested in African stocks, man, and the African space. So I feel when I look at the market there, I see like it's where the US or some of these like global markets were 20 years ago. So I would tell you a simple thing, like an earnings calendar doesn't exist in some of these, like even in Kenya, we don't have an earnings calendar because of the company. So it's something very simple. Something simple as when companies do a release their earnings, that their earnings are actually present, or at least the PDFs are present on the website. So that alone, you have to push companies to actually do something basic like that. So it's an extremely inefficient market, but there's a lot of opportunity to unlock value. Again, also by pushing management to actually raise dividends in some of the companies. Some of those companies, they're performing very well, but the management are stacking up cash just for the sake of it. Some of the management teams are being paid insane amounts of money without delivering value for shareholders for a long period of time. So I think there is a lot of room for activist investing, but also like they're really good companies that are underlooked. So I hope long term to build something there. So also at the same time, I've built a small platform where we do a little bit of analysis on companies and how they're doing. So we create now the earnings calendar. So at the end of maybe month, we tell them, okay, this company reported this date, this company reported this date. Then we show them like, guys, you know, you can tell this to us in advance as investors that we can prepare for it. So the platform is called Mwango Capital. So Mwango is my mom's middle name. So it's inspired by her. And then we've grown incredibly because of the goodwill of a lot of the people and so what they see that we're doing. We've grown from, we had 20 followers in 2020 in November, and now we have 23,000, almost 23,000 followers.
Nice.
On Twitter as a platform. So growing fast and really fulfilling a need. So that's a place where I look at. So I also look at like the Nordic stocks. I haven't really looked at them in a while because I've been busy maybe building up in Africa. But I'm focused on the US, Sweden, and East Africa in Kenya. East Africa and Kenya.
Would you ever be interested in being an activist?
I mean, I would love to shake up some of these companies, but I don't know if I have like the, I prefer management teams that know what they're doing already. I don't know if I have the patience to shake fruit, to shake trees to get fruits. I would love to, but we keep poking them. So the companies telling them, hey, you can do this, you can do that. And some of them respond well, and we really have a good time with them. Are you interested in international stocks yourself?
Yeah. I mean, look, am I interested? Yes. How much does my time go into it? Not much. So I guess I'm not really that interested, but, I am interested. I think where I'm at is, I probably need some help around me in order to start to get done what I want to get done. And I take care of my grandma when I'm, not doing this, and that takes up a decent amount of time, not a ton of time, but I think if I had a team, maybe I could be a little bit more focused on certain things and outsource some tasks. So I'm trying to figure out what the right way to go about that is. I think it's probably some combination of, I don't know if it's Fiverr or Upwork or whatever, but hiring some people that can help.
I have a small team. I can, we can discuss and I can offer their services to you. They help me out in terms of research, background research and some of the projects and stuff that I do. So I've trained them well. They're really, really good with the US companies and stocks also. So we can check that out.
Yeah.
They're good. They can help.
Yeah, it's the training part, right? That is tough.
Training part, yeah. It's a training part, and then also getting them up to speed to your work rhythm. And then once they catch up, then they're very, very useful in terms of helping you at least outsource the non-core tasks. Like now with the transcript, I don't do non-core tasks like edit how something looks like in the newsletter. That's like someone else who does it. My core is just generating the content and then ordering it. And then once that's done, then I source out the non-core stuff of editing, sending out the newsletter. Now it frees up more of my time to do other tasks. So I think that's something that can work for you also.
Yeah, I definitely think it will. And you know who's actually quite good at it is Stream. Think I mentioned it in another episode, but like the way that they pop in and help each other, and they're all remote. So even working with them, seeing it, even though I'm from the outside, but just seeing how they clearly have systems in place. And I think I got to talk to Troy about, he's the founder. I think I got to talk to him about what he thought about in order to create such an efficient machine, because I think, you know, someone's only as good as you give them the opportunity to train them up to, right? So I need to make sure that I think about it the right way coming out of the gate, so I set it up the right way. But I think, you know, maybe you've done it. Maybe just paying your team is a better idea than creating my own. I'm not sure.
I mean, you can discuss and see how they can be of help. You can try them out a bit, but they're really good at the tasks I give them too. So we can see which kind of tasks we can take off your shoulder for you, for the team. They're good, well, though. They're very, very good. They're well trained.
Good. What has been your biggest takeaway from your time at Colossus? And I guess, why don't we narrow it down? Like Malbison, what have you learned from him that you wouldn't have known without him?
I think with Malbison is about just, because right now at Klarna, we're working a little bit on understanding like consumer churn, how that develops across industries. And also something like just understanding how new consumers checking out LTV versus calculating it, and they call it customer-based, you know, valuation kind of models. And also I've learned that a lot from him. I actually recommended some of his articles to the team at Klarna to have a read because of how good they are, but also in terms of like they're good primers for some of these common tasks that you, or at least some of these common concepts that you struggle with. So I think that's been one incredible thing. But then again, also he's an incredible reader, man. He reads like crazy. And for me, that's inspiring. Every time I listen to him, I almost have to record everything because like he will spit out like a lot of like, this is an article I read, this is a book I read, this is an article, this is a book, this is something someone said, the podcast. And then so like for him, like when sitting down with him, it's an hour that is packed with so much that you have like to spend almost the rest of the week just unpacking a lot of the stuff. And it's the same with his podcast also. When you listen to his podcast, it's like this article says, this book says, this article, the other person said and stuff like that. So he connects stuff a lot because of how incredible, so well-read he is. So when you interview with him, you can see like in the background, it's usually like so many shelves of books. You can already see that. And just outside the shelves, there are also more books. So I think for him, I've learned that reading is a lifestyle, man. It's, I would want to replicate. But also, he also combines research and practice very well. So his research is not the kind that you would find in the high towers of academia. It's like the kind of research that is anchored on what people are thinking about. So how is passive investing versus active investing progressing? How is luck versus skill? How do you do a DCF model? How do you think about valuing your customers? How do you think about churn? How do you think about like all this stuff? Like how do you think about intangibles versus tangibles, assets and the valuation? How do these impact value and growth investing and all? So so there's a lot to learn from him in the sense of like he's an incredibly voracious reader, but also an incredibly talented and gifted writer at the same time, whose output is actually really anchored in people's daily needs and daily questions that they have. So sometimes I look at one of the articles he has produced and you're like, oh man, this is something I should have been thinking about. So like you're like, this is something I should have been talking or at least thinking about. But then like it's a natural thing when you look at it like, oh yes, I've been struggling with this question and I didn't even know it myself. But now that I've seen it, I want an answer to it. And then you keep going with that. So I think that's Have you listened to him?
Yeah, well, I've read a lot of what he's written. I think probably my biggest takeaway is on the ideas of expectations investing and competitive advantage periods have been the things that I have tried to push myself to think more and more about. So I got a long, long way to go, and I'll probably never be him, but I hope to interview him in the not too distant future. I got to reach back out to him and see if I can make that happen.
Please do. He's a very busy guy, but still has time also for many people. And I think that's also touching to see from someone who's that busy, but still makes an hour of his time to actually discuss with me, who he's never met, who he may probably never meet again, just to have a conversation about investing and finance. So I think these are the kind of people I tell you that they're very, very open and they're willing to invest in others. And that touches me and makes me want to also do the same to other people at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that your view on that and just saying that makes me want to do it too is probably why people want to do it for you.
Yeah, definitely. But I think it's also the same thing. Like if you're open to other people also want to open up their doors. And if you're trustworthy, people also can trust you with their friends, with their networks, with their resources, with the people that they have. And I mean, it keeps going like that. Then you create a really nice flywheel that keeps going.
Yeah, indeed.
So you benefit from the goodness of others and you also open up yourself to so that you can be a blessing to other people at the same time.
I could not agree more. That's more or less my ethos. And I actually think that's a pretty reasonable thought to wrap up the podcast on, unless you want to say anything else. But, you know, I want to tell you that I really appreciate you coming on and thank you for saying yes. And I hope that this podcast helps you further broaden your network of good people and your flywheel.
Yeah, thank you so much also for having me. I mean, I've been following you for a long while. I think since your cousin who was involved in the Robin Hood case, I think that's when like I really got to know you a bit better. And of course, it's a really heartbreaking story, but also like I can see like the way in which it has transformed you as a person and also like made you become more vocal on Twitter and be more well known there. So I think like it's... I hope also like for me also like to, from that story, at least I've also learned to talk more to my friends about how they approach investing, you know, like not to be day traders or at least to trade on margin a bit too much or to be extremely highly leveraged, to be more cautious in terms of how they do their investing, especially if you're not knowledgeable or you don't know what you're doing at the end of the day, but also to hold some of these platforms accountable to some of the things that they do on the platforms. So I think that's been inspiring also. So it's really nice of you also to reach out and to just want to talk. Really nice to spend time with you also. I've learned a lot. Also in this kind of podcast, you also reflect a lot on some of the things that you have not really thought about in a while. So once again, thank you so much also for having me. And I really look forward to more engaging conversations with as many of your listeners as possible. And also with you also in the future.
Likewise, man. Thank you very much. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you. But it's absolute necessary.